What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Halper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Halper. If you like the show, please leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. We are so excited to be here with you. The world in which we're living is apocalyptic, and I really appreciate everyone who is coming here to tune into this because, honestly, one of our guests tonight is someone who has not been on the show before, but I know everyone will leave the show feeling extremely lucky to have heard from. So I'm really honored that we're going to be having on the show Ramzi Baroud, and I'll tell you more about him shortly. Then we're going to have on Max Blumenthal at the during the second part of the show. But before we start, we're at 350,000 subscribers. So thank you so much to all of you who have subscribed. We're so grateful to you. And also, we are grateful to all of our Patreon supporters, and not to sound like a cliche, but we literally could not do the show without your Patreon support. And so if you're not already a Patreon supporter, we would love that. If you could become one, you get bonus content at the $5 a month level, and that's at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. And if you can't swing that, you can do a $1 a month level, and that way you just get to sleep well at night knowing that you're supporting the show. Oh, and also if you're watching, Donna, we had a party for a family member of mine, and a family friend who I'd never met before came, and she was wearing a Palestine pin. And then she told me she was a Patreon. So thank you again so much, Donna, for being a Patreon. It was great to meet you in person. So we are going to bring on our first guest. And again, I'm so honored and excited to have Ramzi Baroud joining us. We actually met in person at the first ever Jewish Anti-Zionist Congress in Vienna, and I was blown away by his interventions. And Dr. Ramzi Baroud is a journalist, author, and the editor of the Palestine Chronicle. He is the author of 6 books. His forthcoming book, Before the Flood, will be published by 7 Stories Press. His other books include Our Vision for Liberation, My Father is a Freedom Fighter, and The Last Earth. Baroud is a non-resident senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs. And his website is ramzibaroud.net. So welcome, Ramzi.
Thank you for having me, Katie. Great honor.
Thank you. So it's so hard to even talk about this because when I have someone on like you, you are both an expert and an analyst, but you're also a witness. You're someone who's involved in the history and in the story that we're talking about because you are from Gaza. And we're going to get into how it is that you are able to both be a witness and an analyst at the same time. But I just want to offer you my condolences because I know that you just lost your sister. And I want to ask you if there's anything you want to tell us about your sister or any other family members that you've lost. And again, so sorry. And it's so awful when I book guests. It's like, oh, there's a good chance that by the time they appear, there will be more people in their family who have been killed. So,
yeah, it's always a very difficult thing to talk about, but we force ourselves to talk about it because this is not just my personal experience. This is the experience of an entire nation. So when I talk about my sister, I am talking about everybody's sister. When I talk about my cousins and my uncles and their wives or their husbands, I'm talking about everybody's experience in Gaza. I'm not an exception to that. At one point, we were keeping track of the number of people of our family that were killed. I don't know why we were, but at one point it was 56, it jumped to 110. And then I told my my daughters who were keeping track to stop. Because at this point, we kind of enter into a category of anguish and pain that nothing in the world prepares you for this. I mean, you hear about genocide, and it's very, very painful to watch and to follow pictures and images and videos on social media, but to live it, to be you, for you to be the genocide or part of that genocide, and to see the number of your family diminishes slowly, or rather rapidly, over the course of 2 years, I don't think there's any emotional experience or any intellectual explanation or even any spiritual, honestly, discourse that can prepare you for this. So you don't know what to say or to do aside from just staying focused, because there are still people who are still alive and we want them to remain alive. So we fight for them while postponing the grief for later. There will be time for that.
Mm. And is there anything that you'd like to share about your sister? I mean, I heard a great interview that you did on, I believe it was a Counterpunch that you did an interview with recently. And she was a doctor, and you had a really, it was very actually touching and moving and inspiring to hear about how your father was so supportive of your sister. And I believe she's one, the only, you, there are a bunch of boys, and then you had one sister. So what can you tell us about her?
So my sister was a doctor, but she was not an ordinary doctor, because how she became a doctor in itself was a struggle. I mean, it's a promise that my father, who was a socialist, he wanted to believe that he was a communist. I'm doubting that now, but he wanted her to have the kind of education that was denied to most girls in the refugee camp where I was born and raised, the Nusayrat refugee camp, now associated with numerous massacres, including the infamous U.S.-Israeli massacre that killed 700-plus people in the camp. And that's, by the way, that place that was attacked, that was my neighborhood. That was Block 5 in the refugee camp. So that's pretty much everyone I knew. My whole neighborhood and everyone in it was either dead or wounded or still missing. But he made that promise, and he always talked about how the neighbors thought it was ridiculous to even suggest that a refugee who is practically penniless, my father was a member of the Palestine Liberation Army. He refused to join the Israeli police force after the occupation of 1967. We nearly starved as a result of that decision. I heard the word morality, principles, values repeated in my house on a daily basis. I mean, we were feeding on that. So for him to come and make a decision of that nature seemed bizarre, just, you know, to say the least. Yet somehow he made it happen. He worked very, very hard. He denied us, you know, so much in order for this only sister of ours to go to Syria, to Aleppo University, and to become a doctor. And she did. And she was an incredible doctor. Not only because of the work that she has done, she told me just before she was martyred, she said, I have brought so many children to this world, you know, in their capacity as a doctor, and I tried to save so many of them during the genocide, and I couldn't. So she kind of had to experience the life and the deaths of hundreds, literally of hundreds of children and young people in the camp before she was killed. But also she represented a phenomenon that was quite strange in the camp at the time. Now we have so many female doctors in Gaza, but that was because of her generation, because they presented this model that not only it is possible for a female doctor to become a doctor in Gaza, but she could also thrive and build an entire community around her. And she did. So she was very much involved in building a community that is based on community empowerment, but particularly women empowerment. So she was a leader. She was a community leader, and she was very, very beloved by people in the camp. And she was in the hospital, the Nasser Hospital, the last standing hospital in Khan Yunis. And the Israelis were invading Khan Yunis back and forth, and they wanted to make sure that the people in that hospital who were taking refuge are being pushed out. So they began assassinating the doctors and the medical staff, and she was assassinated in her car. Well, she was immediately killed. But the point here is that her legacy continues in Gaza. It will continue in Gaza. I have no doubt about it. That we will make sure that that Suma Barood and everything she has contributed to Gaza is going to be duplicated by so many other amazing women and girls in Khan Yunis, in the Nusayrat refugee camp, and throughout the Gaza Strip. Mm.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And again, it's so horrible. And I am so disgusted that my government is facilitating this, supporting this, justifying it, paying for it. And can you talk about your remaining family or friends who are in Gaza? And honestly, like, how are you even how do you guys stay in touch?
Right. You know, the thing is, many of them are disconnected from one another. Like, they are not able to reach various forms of communication, say between the Shati refugee camp and Khan Yunis, or they are trying to get hold of each other, but they don't. Many of them are still missing. So as a result, I receive calls whenever there is internet available, asking me about other families kilometers away from the ones who are seeking information. So here you are, regardless of where you are in the world, trying to connect your own family or to check to make sure that you know, some are still alive or not. And also many of them may have been, we still don't know, may have been taken by the Israeli army during their various invasions of certain parts of northern Gaza. In particular, a large number of my family were in Beit Hanun, Beit Lahia, Jabalia, Shuja'iyya, Shati refugee camp. So we are still not really sure. We are trying to investigate whether they are still alive with the Israeli army, especially those whose remains haven't as of yet been recovered. There is a sense of, I don't want to say desperation. I think it's something beyond the category of desperation. It's just they don't know. I mean, there's an older uncle of mine in the Mawasi area in Khan Yunis. He whenever he gets a chance to access the internet, he sends me the same message over and over and over again, thinking, oh, Ramzi is a political analyst. He should know when the ceasefire is. And he would say, uncle, the ceasefire, I'm so tired. Every single time. And every single time I try to convey the same message over and over again, that yes, it's happening. It's in the making. It's the matter of a few days and so forth and so on. Is an old man, just to keep, give him that energy to carry on. And I think this is the same feelings that most of the people of Gaza are just, you know, kind of living on hope and prayer that this genocide will be over, and the extermination of the Palestinians will not be complete, and some of them may survive.
You know, one of the things that Israel is doing, obviously, is they have this very targeted killing of doctors, also journalists. And we have, you know, even more sadly, it's like every day the number of journalists killed by Israel goes up. And, you know, this isn't just a question of people killed like in the crossfire. This is intentional assassination. And so over the weekend, Israel assassinated the Al Jazeera journalist Anas al-Sharif after a long campaign where they smeared him as a commander for Hamas. He was killed along with the Al Jazeera crew and the freelance reporter Mohammed al-Khalidi. All of them were gathered in the Al Jazeera tent. And notably, Anas was one of the last and one of the most well-known journalists bringing the news of the atrocities in Gaza City to the world. And the atrocities in northern Gaza. And Israel has killed between 238 and 269 Palestinian journalists and media workers so far that we know of. And I wanted to play a video. Brad, let us know if is the video I sent you up yet? Okay. So I wanted to play a video of Anas al-Sharif reuniting with his daughter earlier this year. And apologies, that doesn't have subtitles, but I just wanted to show a video because Israel is so tries so hard to dehumanize Palestinians that I just thought it was important to see this moving, you know, just an exchange between a man and his daughter. Is there anything, I should have asked you this before, but is there anything relevant that he was saying that I should make sure people know about?
He was just being playful with his daughter, asking her, where have you been? Where have you been? I missed you. Give me a kiss. Where is Salah? I think it's her, his other son, and says Salah is sick. He's at home. So it's that kind of conversation.
Yeah. Right. And we also have a photo. Okay, so these are the other people killed. And a deliberate Israeli strike on a journalist's tent outside Al-Shifa Hospital late Sunday killed 5 Al Jazeera staff and 2 others. And I just wanted to show people their faces because, again, it's just so important to remind people that these are people with faces. And obviously, I heard you in an interview talk about the tension between numbers and people and how both are important because actually the numbers tell a story of genocide. But of course, names tell a story of humanity. And then, of course, there are the countless people we just will never hear about, whose names we'll never hear about. But what are your thoughts on Israel's, you know, murderous targeting of journalists?
Well, Israel is not targeting journalists because of their affiliation with any news agency. They are targeting them because they are Palestinians, because they are Gazans, and because they are the ones who have done something that we couldn't do for 100 years. We have been trying to expose Zionism for 100 years. We've been trying to balance out the horrific and imbalanced and biased reporting in mainstream media about Palestine and the Palestinians, the dehumanization of the Palestinians. And we have been begging the likes of the New York Times and the Washington Post and the BBC, please tell the story, tell the truth. And we would even celebrate if there is a single report or a commentary that makes it to the New York Times that is nominally balanced or nominally pro-Palestine. And yet none of this worked. And then Israel decides to carry out a genocide in Gaza. And what do? They block access to all foreign and international journalists. And as a result, they were under the impression that the story of Gaza is going to die because there's nobody to tell the story. But guess what? The Palestinians of Gaza, they haven't been to Ivy League universities, are not graduates from Oxford or Harvard. Most of them went to Azhar University, Islamic University, Birzeit, Beit Lahem. Yet at the same time, they ended to be the most powerful narrators of the Palestinian story. And this has been extremely frustrating for Israel. So they began building this narrative. The narrative that every Palestinian journalist in Gaza is automatically Hamas. Not just that, they have also, many of them have entered into Israel on October 7 and so forth. And, you know, mainstream media, whom we are fighting against, gave these kind of claims, these fraudulent claims, a lot of space, a lot of credibility. I don't just blame the killing of Anas and 270 Palestinian journalists, in addition to hundreds of intellectuals, artists, bloggers, social media influencers, young scholars, storytellers who have been everywhere, you know, kind of narrating the story of Gaza. I don't just blame it on Netanyahu alone. I blame it to those who have given Netanyahu the space and the room to make that argument in the first place, therefore dehumanizing and demonizing the Palestinians in the media and elsewhere. They all played part in it. And in fact, even after the murder of Anas al-Sharif and Qureta and all these other journalists, even then, the likes of Haaretz and others would create these kind of selective headlines to give credibility to Netanyahu's, narrative that they may indeed have been terrorists and so forth and so on. But this is part of it. And I think it's really important, Katie, here to mention something. For a long time, we have been indoctrinated with this idea that the Zionist propaganda is bulletproof, is incredible, it's amazing. We cannot, you know, we need to learn from how clever design. No, it's not the case at all. The Zionist propaganda is powerful because the Palestinian voice and the pro-Palestinian voice is eliminated from mainstream conversation, from mainstream discourses in academia and everywhere else. And now in Gaza, they are physically being eliminated, murdered, assassinated, because they, just by their mere presence of telling basic facts on the ground in Gaza, they are able to cancel out all the lies and propaganda of Zionism and of Israel. And this really, I mean, it's as horrific as this may sound, or the timing of it maybe being insensitive, it is quite validating that everything we have been saying, that the story belongs to the Palestinians, that the truth is in the hands of the Palestinians in Gaza, in the rest of Palestine. So center them, give them the space to talk, to express, to write, and to present their own narrative. And the Zionist narrative will automatically be defeated as a result. And I think the killing of all these journalists in Gaza is a proof that Israel has no ability to counter the information coming out of Gaza. Why kill them if you can counter their narrative? It's because Anas was a very powerful, like the other powerful 270 journalists who have been telling us the truth about what is going on in Gaza and the context of why this is happening in Gaza.
And how do you as a person balance elevating stories told by Palestinians, reporting done by Palestinians, with debunking Zionist lies? Because that's something I struggle with, because sometimes, you know, it kind of gets to what is our purpose as, different people have different roles, but you know, sometimes I'm like, no, we have to debunk these things because I know a lot of people who actually believe them. And then other times I'm like, you know what? It's pointless. These people are not reachable. They're brainwashed. What are your thoughts on this question?
That's a brilliant question. In fact, I have been considering this question today, looking at the coverage of the murder of the 6 or 7 Palestinian journalists yesterday. And that is, we are so focused on trying to prove that Israel is not correct and that these journalists were not terrorists. By the way, this is exactly the main discourse of countering everything that Israel has been throwing at us. The Shifa Hospital, they said, is the headquarters of Hamas. We spend so much time trying to prove that this is not the case. Oh, it was a Palestinian missile that was fired at the Baptist Hospital in Gaza and killed all these people. And then we invest so much time and energy trying to, but notice that whether we succeed in debunking or fail in doing so, the conversation is still controlled by Netanyahu. The conversation is still controlled by Israel. So my method of doing journalism, the same method I have in writing books, is ignore Israel. Just tell your truth. Just say your truth. And as a result, you are going to cancel or at least marginalize the Zionist narrative. Create your own independent platforms like your show, Katie. Extremely important. We need more and more such initiatives. And then you can, you know, cater the conversation or direct the conversation in the way that it should have been directed, which is bringing and centering the Palestine narrative and the pro-Palestine narrative, and not waste too much time in trying to debunk. I mean, think about it this way. The Israeli claims are so ludicrous that it just makes no sense. Why would anyone even make, you know, how could anyone even believe such nonsense in the first place? But this is not intended to be logical propaganda. It is intended to be so outrageous so that we are all kind of, you know, kind of running head over heels, so desperate in trying to prove how ludicrous it is. And every single time, so much of that, and of course, mainstream media is going to give Netanyahu and Israel, you know, the first account. Tell us your story, Israel, and come, Katie Ramsey and everybody else, come and try to debunk. Well, I don't have the chance to appear on CNN. I am irrelevant to Fox News. And therefore, the most ridiculous part of the Israeli narrative that makes it to mainstream media in the first place. So what do? We listen to what the Palestinians themselves are saying. Do you think the Palestinians in Gaza are so worried about debunking what Netanyahu is saying or not saying? Their priorities are entirely different. They have a political discourse. They have a historical context. They have a social context. They have a spiritual way of life, and they have faith, and they have reasons of why they are fighting. They want to tell you about the genocide, but they also want to tell you that we will not stop resisting, that we are still standing, that they would kill us until the last person, and we are not going to surrender. This is the narrative that requires to be centered. But quite often we marginalize this narrative, and we just basically spend so much time and energy trying to prove that Netanyahu is a liar. And whether we do or not, I really don't think it is so consequential in the long run. Do you think that European leaders and the ruling classes of Western society do not know that Netanyahu is a liability and is a liar? They know all of these things, but they are governed by different set of interests. And this is why I do agree with the viewpoint that says, no, you center Palestinians, representative Palestinian voices, by the way, and spend so much of your energy on that. Debunk if you must, but don't let that be your main focus.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's hard, especially I feel like it's so important to, we can't debunk every single point, right? Because they are so good at throwing out constant smears and lies. So we would be, as you said, we would be kind of like reacting and reactive the entire time instead of centering voices or amplifying or elevating voices. I do think sometimes it's useful to just show, give away like tricks that the media uses. Because as people have pointed out, you know, and Craig McIver has pointed out in writing, and he mentioned this on this show, that, you know, media can be held accountable in genocide. There's been historic precedents for that, Rwanda, for example. But, you know, just seeing the way that headlines kind of launder propaganda into headlines that they claim are objective, you know, by just repeating Israeli talking points, talking about how this person is Hamas. This person was accused of Hamas. Was he Hamas? I mean, there was even a BBC article or show that was like, well, is it okay to kill five journalists when you just want to kill one? As if just wanting to kill one journalist is okay.
That's right. And also, Katie, don't forget, when we constantly trying to disassociate certain individuals or certain entities from Hamas, from the resistance, from you are basically kind of accepting certain facts that are being promoted by Israel, that to being a member of any resistance group, being Islamist, being socialist, being secular, is in itself a sin. And therefore, any Palestinian who is killed, therefore, cannot be a member of a family, of a resistance family somewhere in Gaza, because doing so, it's a really, really bad thing. But the fact is, Gaza society largely supports the resistance. And many of them are indeed invested in that. So why should we play their game?
Yeah, and that's another thing. It's like a lot of people will say, oh, well, you know, Palestinians are not Hamas, or Palestinians are not the resistance. Palestinians are just normal people who want to live and feed their families. You know, there's this kind of almost like narrative divide and conquer. And sometimes people, I think, are actually doing it. I honestly think sometimes people are not doing it in bad faith. Then there are people who do in bad faith. But it kind of speaks to the overt in window and what's acceptable, resistance and self-defense.
And it also takes agency from Palestinians.
Yeah.
I mean, we Palestinians or our families in Gaza are not just sitting, you know, when we say they are starving. No, they are not starving. They are being starved.
Right.
You know, they are dying. They are not dying. They are being killed. But at the same time, they are also standing and they are also fighting and they are practicing sumud, steadfastness, at a cultural level that we have never seen before. So there are people with agency. So when we kind of try to, maybe, as you said, many of us do it with good intentions, but in the process of doing so, we are also doing some degree of dehumanization, because we are declaring that they are not agents, they are not political agents, and they are not capable of making any change. And is that really the case? I mean, what the Palestinians in Gaza have done to the Israeli army is more than all Arab armies combined have done over the course of 75 years. You can't tell me people who are doing that have no agency. We need to talk right about this agency, and we need to talk about their resistance. It doesn't mean we agree with every single thing and every single ideology, but that's very important to the conversation. Otherwise, we're being dishonest about it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, it speaks again to the fact that there's no conversation about international humanitarian law, what it means to live under occupation, what rights there are, how you are allowed to use armed resistance against your occupier, against combatants. That's never included. Israel gets to claim it's defending itself. Everyone rallies around that. And then anyone who engages in the actual self-defense, because we all know that Israel doesn't, but if you engage in actual self-defense and you're Palestinian, then you're a terrorist. But yeah, I think that, you know, it just, again, it speaks to how, I mean, there was a guy, a Republican, we cover this on Monday morning, the show I do with Aaron Mate. We cover this on Monday morning. There's a Republican from Arkansas who actually called Hamas subhuman. Subhuman. He said that on Fox. I mean, he said that on television. And so you get why people, and I'm not like letting people off the hook, but you get why people are so quick to de-link Palestinians from Hamas because they know that they're being called subhuman. But then we perpetuate, I think, this problematic, taking away agency, vilifying all forms of armed resistance, and total double standard and hypocrisy. Because again, no one ever questions. When I say no one, I mean mainstream media or the media elites and politicians never question Israel's violence. It's just Palestine's violence.
And this is where we go back to your original point about, do you spend more time debunking versus centering Palestinian voices? And, you know, when you approach it from, no, they're not subhumans, they are freedom fighters. And you kind of enter into that sort of conversation. And then, oh, wait a minute, is Katie saying that Palestinians have the right to defend themselves? What does that mean about Ramzi or Katie or anybody else? And then you become accused. No. I think the best approach to this is you just create just narratives, people's history, why people make the choices they do. And I did that in a previous book. I've done it with my book, My Father Was a Freedom Fighter. I've done it with The Last Earth. I'm doing it with my forthcoming book, Before the Flood. And I don't enter into any sort of reactionary or any sorts of, these kind of angry responses. I don't even engage with the Zionist narrative at all about resistance. Now, if you as a reader, you are going to, or as a viewer or a listener, and you are going to understand the facts and know why people make the choices they do and still think that Palestinians don't have the right to defend themselves, even during the times of genocide, then I think you have a bigger problem than simple human logic. But most people, when they listen to this, because, you know, Hamas is a new movement from a historical point of view. Hamas did not start until 87, right? And did not even, the Qassam brigades did not really become a thing that is, you know, until 2008, 2009. Prior to that, it was the socialist. It was the communist of Gaza that fought in the 60s and in the 70s. And prior to that, there was no ideology. We call them the fida'iyin, the freedom fighters. These were peasants. They were fallahin that were pushed off their lands and they went to Gaza. And all they wanted to do is just to go back, to harvest their lands, to claim the gold that they left behind, the little money they left behind. So they formed these groups called the fida'iyin, the freedom fighters. There was no ideology involved. There was no Islamic anything or Christian anything. They were just ordinary people. So if you are going to dismiss Hamas, for example, fine. How about the socialists? And prior to that, how about the Communist Party that really started the armed resistance in Gaza along with the PFLP? And how about the others who just fought because that's what you do? When your family is being murdered, when your village is being burned, you just fight back. What kind of explanation does Netanyahu and his ilk have for this kind of historical facts or this kind of collective behavior on the part of the Palestinians?
Well, speaking of the attacks on journalism and attacks on Palestinian voices, you guys at Palestine Chronicle have experienced this. And I have an article that we can show on the screen, but I thought it'd be ideal for you to explain in your own voice what has happened at the Palestine Chronicle in terms of the smears that you guys have faced.
Right. Well, it's the price of centering because the Palestine Chronicle is, you know, tried to bring a new model of journalism, independent Palestinian journalism, where we are not affiliated with any faction because many, many Palestinian media outlets, you know, they have the right to do so, are affiliated with this political group, this ideology or not. And we don't. And we wanted to show that you can actually do very serious independent journalism without being affiliated, but rather try to center the voices of ordinary people in Gaza. So we will just seek the everyday narrative of Palestinians. And even prior to the genocide, our work, whenever there's a sports event, a football game, a religious celebration, Christmas, a church, a mosque, we would cover that to show that Palestinians, have a very thriving culture and society and a very competitive academic life and that sort of thing. And we wanted to show all of that. And as a result, we have brought so many people from Gaza. Quite often, we would actually train them to be writers, to be journalists, and we would give them the space to write and to express themselves. Well, when the Nusayrat massacre took place, one of the 700 plus people who were killed was a journalist, and many people were, writing about this journalist and the fact that Israel once more is targeting journalists in Gaza. Well, it happened that that person made contributions to the Palestine Chronicle. The Israeli army declared that that particular person was actually one of the, hostage takers. No proofs, no nothing. They just wanted to indict all journalists, because once you kind of make that claim, the New York Times is going to report on it, and they did. So as a result, well, where did he write? They looked at the Palestine Chronicle and they saw the opportunity that if you demonize the Palestine Chronicle, you could shut it down. And if you do so, you create this legal precedent that would allow you to shut down other independent think tanks, NGOs, other academic and media organizations and advocacy groups anywhere in the U.S. So all of the resources, over 20 lawyers, four major legal firms, are now dedicated to smearing the Palestine Chronicle. They took us to court. We won because the judge thought this is silly. You have no proof. You just made something up. And unfortunately, they came back with vengeance. And there's another case, and we are fighting it largely on our own while they are making these ridiculous claims. Of course, they can't prove anything because there is nothing to prove. But this is just comes to show you how dangerous having a truly independent voice that tries to give space and platforms for the ordinary Palestinians to speak. So they want to kill the Palestinians. They want to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians. They want to starve the Palestinians. And they want to kill the very journalists who dare even convey these atrocities, or anyone like the Palestine Chronicle that creates platforms for journalists and others to convey the pain, the collective pain of their own people. This is what we are dealing with. And honestly, we are unfazed. I mean, what we are going through does not even register as anything compared to what our colleagues in Gaza are going through. So, of course, we're not going to stop. We're not going to be weakened or slow down. It's a mission that we have to continue until the very end.
Right. Yeah, I think it's really hard for people to talk about what's happening here, like the arrests that are happening here, the crackdown on speech that's happening here, because it's almost like offensive to suggest that there's a parallel. But it's not that there's a parallel, but it is the domestic front of the same war. And actually, speaking of war, I heard you say something fascinating. You said how you do refer to a war that's happening now. And when you do that, people rightfully say, no, it's not a war, it's a genocide. But you actually are talking about a different kind of war from the other side. Can you elaborate on that?
You mean a war from the side of the Palestinians?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, for Palestinians, I mean, we do see this as a war. I mean, it is a war, but it's for us, it's a war of liberation. I mean, it's plain and simple. Because you cannot, kind of take the dignity away from the Palestinian to tell him, I can't even dignify what you are doing as a war. Or as a liberation war. It's completely irrelevant. You have no agency, but you don't even have the means of even sustaining that kind of liberation war. But when you think about it, I don't think there's a greater liberation war that we have seen maybe since the liberation war of Algeria that compares to what the Palestinians are doing in Gaza. And it's so very important to do so because the genocide will be over. And then we are going to come and talk about, well, who represents the Palestinians? And the ones who represent the Palestinians are not those who are collaborating with Israel, not those who are doing security coordinations with Israel. but rather are those who are representing their people and fighting for their rights. So yes, it is a genocide because we can't control what our enemy does to us. And I can't decide for Netanyahu to take over Gaza City or the whole of the Gaza Strip. It's a decision he makes. It's the immorality he's responsible for. It's the illegality that he brings to the table. But as a Palestinian or as a Palestinian people, we do have choices. And our choice is to resist and to fight back. And so for us, this is a war. It's a war of liberation from our side. For Israel, it's a war of complete dishonor. And it's an utter and absolute genocide that will bring shame to anyone who has defended or explained or justified or rationalized what Israel's doing to the Palestinians until the very end.
Right. I also want to talk to you about the role of literature in resistance. It makes me think of, for instance, the great Rifat al-Arir, who said that if his home was invaded, if the Israeli soldiers came for him, that if he could do nothing else, he would throw his pens at the IDF. And that would be the last thing he did. And I want to just ask you more generally about the way, you know, because we see that words are so threatening to the IDF and to Netanyahu and truth telling. But it seems like also it's also writing and storytelling and literature in itself that is a threat. Can you expand on this?
Well, Israel is terrified by the Palestinian intellectual. Israel has always been scared of the Palestinian intellectual. I don't think there is a revolution in which its intellectuals were hunted down and assassinated worldwide the same way that Palestinian intellectuals have. From Majid Abu Sharar, assassinated in Rome in 81, to Ghassan Kanafani, assassinated in Beirut in 72, and numerous before, in between, and after. And now we see it happening in Gaza openly. Intellectuals like Rifat al-Arir is being told, you're going to die. We're coming for you. Openly. And then they do. They carry it out. The likes of Anas Shareef. I mean, this is all form of intellect. They are organic intellectuals. I mean, until Gaza and the genocide in Gaza, I believe that the concept of organic intellectual has largely subsisted as an intellectual idea, as a notion. But now we actually see it in practice. These militant intellectuals who are standing their ground. And by the way, there's so much of the intellectual production of Gaza that we don't see. We don't know about, we don't hear of, but it's happening at a grassroots level. You know, who keeps those people in refugee camps, in Mawasi, taking shelters in schools and hospitals? Who keeps their spirit up? Who lectures to them? Who talks to them? It's the intellectuals of Gaza. They are operating at every level of society, from Rafah in the south to Beit Hanun in the north. And they are terrifying for Israel because they are indeed the ones who are keeping this the will of the Palestinians intact. People lose everything and they tell you, but I will, you know, I remain standing. I will continue. There's a lady that I watched this interview with going from the south back to northern Gaza. And she was elated. She was so happy. And the journalist asked her from Al-Mayadeen, he says, why are you so happy? She said, well, I lost all of my five sons. And he said, but there's another reason for me to ask you, why are you happy? She said, because I want to rebuild the house and plant olive trees that represents every son that I have lost. And I want to live in my house until I die. What poetry, what literature can possibly explain the will and the power of that woman? I see this little Maria, a cute little girl, 5 years old. Every single day, she has intellectual production on Instagram and TikTok. Poetry in English, in Arabic, Quranic verses, Mahmoud Darwish, sometimes just speeches, random political speeches. I follow her faithfully because I actually get a lot of my inspiration from a five-year-old girl in Gaza City. So the intellect of Gaza, it is so incredibly important to the survival of Gaza. And it's, you know, what Israel tries to diminish, to destroy, to kill the spirit of Gazans, these intellectuals, these organic intellectuals, a representation of their classes, of the workers and the teachers and the poor people of Gaza. They are the ones who are keeping this Palestinian spirit alive. And they are doing it almost in total isolation, by the way, from the world. They don't know what we are saying outside. They rarely access the news. They rarely see anything, any intellectual production by anyone else outside of Gaza. So they are almost kind of this, you know, they are just relying on themselves to survive in every possible way. We talk about the famine in Gaza. I think the famine should have been a lot worse in terms of its ability to kill people. But why is, you know, if we just know how Gazans share everything. I lived in Gaza during previous intifadas and uprisings. And I remember young people coming during the military curfew, knocking at the door in the middle of the night and tossing these little plastic bags with a tomato, a cucumber, baby powder, you know, cigarettes from my dad. They knew who has a baby and who doesn't. And they would come and just risk their lives in order for them to share the very little that they are able to salvage to keep the people going, to keep the uprising going, to keep the revolution going. Gaza is an exceptional society. And honestly, I think, and I'm not blaming anyone aside from us, Palestinian intellectuals outside Gaza, I don't think we have done a good job in conveying how special Gaza is and has been. And it's partly because we have always been arguing that this is a conflict over land. And Gaza doesn't have land. It's a conflict over resources. Gaza has no resources. And therefore, Gaza was dropped almost completely out of the intellectual and academic and media conversation. But Gaza is the heart of Palestinian resistance. And resistance is the heart of Palestinian history. You can't tell the Palestinian history without talking about Gaza first and foremost. Mm.
And I'm sorry, what is the name of the little girl who you said you watched?
Maria.
Okay, what I'm wondering if we can find a clip of her. And you know, of course, there it's interesting because there's such an attack on UNRWA, right? And UNRWA, of course, is one of the ways that I mean the literacy rates in Gaza are like statistically abnormal, right? They're like off the charts. So you can understand, of course, why Israel is so threatened by UNRWA. We see that they were threatened by UNRWA, so they had to lie and pretend they were infiltrated by terrorists. And that is, of course, so that could also shut off the food distribution, the aid distribution. And now we're seeing, you know, they are doing it through this monstrous evangelical right-wing mercenary killing machine, killing field. I mean, it is like a death trap. You know, they're luring people in. I keep saying that when I first heard about it, I kind of immediately thought of the showers, like in concentration camps and Jews being told that they were going to take a shower. Here, go take a shower. And then, of course, they were gassed. And Gabor Mate compared it to how the Nazis would lure people out of the ghettos with promises of food. And then that's how they would, you know, get them onto the concentration camps. And, you know, I've said this before because a lot of people on the show have been saying this, and a lot of people I interview lately say this. They're like, you know, I used to avoid, for various reasons, I would avoid comparisons between the Nazis and Israel, Nazis and the IDF. And a lot of people are saying like they are no longer able to, not they're not saying it's like one-to-one. It's in an exact analogy. But so many people I've spoken to say they're no longer able to not draw some of the parallels or not point out some of the striking similarities. So I want to know what your... and I pressed this by accident, sorry. Bless you, Katie, for exposing the Zionist lies. I'm still processing the children buried alive. Bless the Palestinian people for their tenacity. That is, by the way, thank you, Naomi, so much. That's a reference to... we had two amazing doctors on the show who have both been to Gaza more than once. Feroz Sidwa and Mark Perlmutter, and they talked about a story that they are bringing to the ICJ where apparently two Palestinians, children were buried alive. Sorry, I lost my train of thought because I was saying something.
No,
the Holocaust, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I know for a long time this has been a kind of like a sensitive topic. Right. But I think we can talk about it now. I, for example, I did not use Palestine Holocaust or Gaza Holocaust as a hashtag on Twitter before the genocide. I just did not want to make comparisons, and I wanted the Palestinian struggle to be understood within its proper historical context. But now it is. It is, because the idea here is to exterminate the Palestinian people, and the Israelis are not shying away from it. I mean, they are making our life a lot easier when Eliyahu, the Minister of Heritage, for example, comes and says, well, we can always drop a nuclear bomb. You know, if we can't finish them off using traditional means, we can. So I think that kind of should end the debate about it. But I think what makes it really, really difficult for Gazans, that makes our story particularly painful, is the fact that we, you know, this process of waiting that someone is going to come to the rescue, you know. And I grew up by the beach in Gaza, and I just remember how people used to have it spread these rumors, you know, in that you know, the such and such army is coming to help us. You know, and we would actually go to the beach and we would sit for hours and hours looking for the boats coming. And only later on in life, I realized what a silly notion that was. And of course, nobody did come. And then you would think, well, maybe because they did not know the nature of the atrocities, or the, but everyone now knows. You see it live. You see it. You experience it. It is inescapable. And yet nobody came. And that is just really one of the things that is going to linger the most. I think it's going to create all sorts of redefinition of our very identity. Where are our brethren? Where are the Muslims? Where is the defenders of human rights? Where is the international community? Numerous questions that are now, you know, being asked. And I think, I don't know if you can possibly come up with an answer when the genocide is over. Because if you don't stand up for what is right when people are being exterminated in mass, what is the point of your solidarity later on?
Right. That, and that's something we're dealing with. I mean, I think a lot of people are struggling with this, because in some ways it's like, okay, finally people are speaking out. Of course, where were they on October 8th, honestly, if we're being honest about it, you know? So it's both a sign of, I don't know. I don't even know. I don't want to say a sign of progress. It's a sign that hopefully it's a sign that people are waking up, but the fact that they weren't awake before is so disturbing. So Andrew actually found two Marias. I'm not sure which one it is. There's this young girl.
This is Maria. Yes. Okay. I think that's
okay. She's so cute. Okay.
That's one of her early videos.
Okay. So let's just take a look at this.
مرحبا عزيزي ترامب رئيس الولايات المتحدة الأمريكية معك الطفلة ماريا حنون من غزة.
Wow. بدي أسألك سؤال. She's really 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 cute. And
yeah. I love the fact that she doesn't speak in small short segments. It's a continuous thought. Right. She's a very very smart girl.
Yeah. Well, Ramzi, you've been so generous with your time. It's really late where you are. Anything else you want to make sure we cover, or any final words? And we're going to bring you back on for sure, especially because I have to read your books, which I was confessing before that I've been so busy reading your journalism that I now going to get to your books. But I've read reviews of them and I've read excerpts and they're amazing. So I'm really excited about that.
First of all, thank you very much for having me, Katie, and I look forward to joining you again in the future. Thank you for the incredible work you have been doing. I've been following you for a long time. I think my only message I want to finish with is something that I've also, like a trap I've also fell into, which is expecting others to do something. You know, where is this entity? Why is that the left is not doing anything? Why the Arabs? And at the end of the day, it turned out that you really just need to start with yourself. Every single one of us is capable of making a difference. And you know that difference more than me or anybody else. So learn more about Palestine. Learn from a Palestinian point of view as much as you can. Immerse yourself in understanding our history and our culture. And take action. Start with yourself. And trust me, the world will eventually change.
And one thing I want to add is a statement from Anas, one of his last statements. He said, if this madness does not end, Gaza will be reduced to ruins, its people's voices silenced, their faces erased, and history will remember you as silent witnesses to a genocide that you chose not to stop. Silence is complicity. So that's kind of the opposite, the other side of what you're saying. So that's the other face of it. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Ramzi. This has been really amazing. Thank you so much for your time. And again, condolences. I'm so sorry about your sister.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Katie. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. Have a great night. That was a wonderful conversation. It's so excited to read Ramzi's books. And I really recommend everyone follow him on Twitter, follow his website, go to Palestine Chronicle. And as you can see, just from hearing him, he's such a great thinker and speaker and writer. We're going to keep the show going. So excited to be bringing onto the show a fan fave, someone who needs very little introduction. He's the author of several books and the editor, The Gray Zone, Mr. Max Blumenthal. I don't know why I said Mr., but hi, Max.
Hey, Katie. How's it going?
Good. You?
I'm well.
Yeah. There's a lot to talk about, and I'm just going to put you on the spot and ask you, do you want to talk about your latest article at The Gray Zone? Do you want to talk about Shabbos Kestenbaum, who I went up against on Pierce Morgan / PragerU? Or do you want to talk about Jonathan Greenblatt?
Can we talk about something that doesn't involve Jews? Is that possible? Jews being bad?
Yeah. Oh, because you don't want to be accused of anti-Semitism?
I'm joking.
I know. We have to have like a bad non-Jew. Right? We have to make sure that to be fair, we got to shout out to Christian Zionists and PragerU. It does a lot of stuff with Christian Zionists, but yeah. Yeah. What's your pleasure? What's your Jew pleasure?
You know, it's up to you. I mean, the article is really about the looming Israeli reoccupation of Gaza. So, I mean, we can start with that.
Something light
down the line.
Yeah. Something light and funny. Yeah. Your latest piece is Israel's government issues, quote, death sentence, end quote, to remaining captives. So tell us about this.
Well, it was just a thought that came to me as Netanyahu invoked his plan to invade Gaza or to reoccupy Gaza, to send troops into the three major populated areas where they believe that Hamas still exercises control, Gaza City, Deir al-Balah, and Nuseirat refugee camp in the center of Gaza. And really what it's about is actually ethnic cleansing, pushing the population to the south. But that's likely where the 10 remaining captives are. And it was clear to me because I was one of the first English language reporters after October 7th to call out the Mass Hannibal Directive, putting the pieces together. To explain how Israel likely killed hundreds of its own citizens on October 7th to deny Hamas negotiating leverage, and that what they're going to try to do is a final Hannibal. And they want to eliminate these final captives. And then, you know, mainstream voices like the Forum for Hostages and Missing People, which is the organization of the families who have members of their family in Gaza, the Israeli families who have members of their family held captive in Gaza, they said the same thing. They said this is a death sentence for them. This was their language. Eyal Zamir, who's the chief of staff, who probably doesn't want to do this, but he's being a good soldier and following orders to escalate the genocide. He warned that this would put the captives in grave peril, and Hamas said the same thing. So, of course, Israel wants the Israeli government, and specifically the fanatics in the government, like Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, who said rescuing the hostages is not the most important thing. He openly said it. They want to see to it that these captives die. And in their preferred scenario, they'll die at the hands of Al-Qassam guards, who are the armed wing of Hamas, who will kill them according to a policy they announced after Israel first invaded the Nuseirat camp in order to extricate the captive Noah Argamani and five others. And what it did was it slaughtered over 200 people in an open-air market, just flooded the area with munitions, and then executed people all the way up through an apartment building, executed a journalist and his entire family at point-blank range in order to get them out. And so Al-Qassam said, if you come close to where we're holding captives, again, we'll kill the captives. And so they went for Hirsch Goldberg Pollan, who was one of the most kind of famous, notable hostages, who's, I think his family spoke at the Democratic convention, and they they were a pro ceasefire family. So he was kind of a problem for Israel in a way. I don't want to get conspiratorial, but they homed in on his location, went for him, and he and I think a handful of others were killed according to this policy. So that's it. And then they said, "Oh, Hamas did it. Hamas killed them, and Hamas needs to be exterminated." So they're going to try to do that again. I mean, that's what I think their objective is, although they won't openly come out and say it. And the reoccupation is not that popular, not as popular in Israel as other phases of this war were, because, I mean, the liberal Zionists primarily care about Jewish life, but they see Jewish life is going to be snuffed out here, along with, you can already see the bloodshed taking place as they're kind of laying the groundwork for an invasion and or a reinvasion. And then that brings us to Anas al-Sharif, who was the most prominent journalist with the biggest platform and the most professional crew in Gaza. So they killed, that was the opening salvo of the invasion, was to kill him in order to sort of blind the rest of us to what's going on. And you can see, I think the journalist Abu Bakr al-Abed made the point that there just isn't as much coverage right now coming out of Gaza. Some of the other journalists I know in Gaza, they do incredible coverage, but they're not on the scene like Anas was. They're not risking themselves as much as he did. And he comes from that kind of the tradition. The lead correspondent for Al Jazeera Arabic was always sort of like the trying to be the first on the scene and had the resources to do so. And I mean, look at what happened to all of his predecessors.
Yeah.
Only one survived, and most of his family was slaughtered. Then Ismail al-Ghul was killed, had his head blown off while he was just covering an event. I guess it was covering mourners going to the home of, my brain is freezing right now, in the Shati refugee camp, the home of the Hamas leader who was assassinated in Iran. And then they killed Hossam Shabbat, severed his body in half with a drone strike while he was going to Beit Hanun to cover the aftermath of an airstrike. They always do it like at the around the time of a major event,
Haniya,
or at the beginning
the way,
of a major. It's always like when they assassinate the Al Jazeera correspondent, it's always a harbinger of something horrible.
It's so sick. I mean, they also, one of the ones that also stands out for me was the Al Jazeera cameraman, Samer Abu Dhaka, who died in an Israeli strike, but did not have to die. He bled out over the course of hours because Israel would kill, block, and bomb the attempts to rescue him and treat him. So he was left bleeding to death over the course of hours. Like 6 hours later. It's just so disgusting. You know, it's like war crime after war crime. And yet Israel defenders, he was Hamas. I mean, what's so amazing about all these excuses is that they're just like openly saying that they're okay with war crimes because they're so spoiled and coddled and they have such impunity that they don't realize that they're admitting to things that aren't actually legal to do. Like, but they're just so used to using the "but Hamas" as an excuse that they're like, "Oh, it's okay. We killed a bunch of civilians in a hospital because there was one Hamas guy." And it's like, well, actually, first of all, he wasn't there. But even if he was, that's still a war crime.
Yeah, I saw some reporter from either I-24 or the Times of Israel go even further and say, "Well, people in Gaza who opposed Hamas claimed that Anas al-Sharif's coverage was distorted. And here's one person complaining." It's like, oh, well,
death penalty.
Then let's assassinate like everybody in the media.
Right. Yeah.
Like at least the corporate media.
Right. Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Distorting your coverage gets you blown up along with your camera crew.
Yeah. I also like the very moral position of people who are saying, you know, that child who was basically like skeletal skin and bones. You know, the big defense of Israel, their big zinger was, oh, the New York Times, you're a bunch of propagandist liars, because that baby who's starving to death, who's being starved to death, has cerebral palsy. So there you go.
Yeah, he's one of the Untermenschen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's like, you know, we believe that not babies don't deserve to be killed. It's just babies who have cerebral palsy.
Well, when the Zionist movement was importing Jews into Palestine, pre-state Palestine, Chaim Weizmann and David Ben-Gurion were very, very opposed to bringing in Jews who had pre-existing conditions, who were old, who were not strong. They said, we need good human material. And those who are old will be, I think in Chaim Weizmann's words, yeah, dust and bone.
Disgusting.
And they'll be, you know, scattered into the wind. David Ben-Gurion went to the displaced persons camps in Europe and would take notes on, you know, who could be brought and who couldn't. I mean, this is a very cynical movement that founded this country. And the cynicism now extends into their ethnic cleansing policies, where they're, Netanyahu has declared that a minimum of aid has to go into Gaza, so some people can survive.
Unfortunately, right?
And they'll all be subjected to these humiliating scenes where they're fighting over the aid, and naturally it creates a black market effect. So all the families depending on aid, well, because there's no economy, because the whole UNRWA system was blown up and there's no economy in the entire Gaza Strip. All those families, if they have a sick child, they're just going to have to sacrifice that kid under these circumstances. And that was Mohammed Zakaria Al-Mutawik, who we interviewed at the Gray Zone through our stringer in Gaza, Mohammed Al-Saifi, just to kind of show how the Israel's propaganda brigades, how twisted they were by trying to portray this child as expendable, or his parents as somehow irresponsible. Let's hear what the mother has to say about their situation. His father was killed by Israel, first of all, the main breadwinner in the family. They killed him. He was out looking for food and they killed him in, I believe, a drone strike.
Yeah, we have the video. So,
why isn't that mentioned in the New York Times clarification?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. Yeah. Brad, sorry, I'm just going to send you, I'm texting you a link to this. You'll see this is a really important article. And this article has a video, and this is from the Gray Zone that you guys, I guess, you have a stringer there who interviewed the mother. And yeah, we should show this because it's...
Well, let's... We could like throw it in the chat.
Okay, you want to just put a link?
Show like 30 seconds of it. I mean, it's kind of like...
It is really upsetting. Yeah, we can just... Okay, we'll throw it in the chat then. I'll put it in.
This will be shown at the future.
Yeah, Holocaust, it is. I mean, it's,
Museum of the
yeah,
Gaza
it was
Holocaust.
Very upsetting. It's like we showed it last week on Useful Idiots, and it's, you know, I was very hard for me to not cry on air because it's so awful. And then like to have to kind of like defend the right of this child not to be starved to death, despite the fact that, you know, they have cerebral palsy. It's just like that's where we are. Well, I mean, it is interesting how it's disgusting, but it's sometimes I'm like, well, maybe all these, I guess so many Zionists though are so much more excited about killing Palestinians than they are about saving Jewish lives, right? Because all these people who care about Jews, and that's like Israel's shtick, right? To be a safe haven. We know that Netanyahu doesn't care. And he's, as you said, and you wrote in your article, he's perfectly happy. In fact, it's his preference to have these people killed. But you would think that more like liberal Zionists would be up in arms about the effect that Israel's policy is having on the hostages. Like they don't care about Palestinians.
They are up in arms. They interrupted like one of the top Israeli reality shows.
Yeah.
Like a group of liberal Zionist women. You see these protests all the time. Like they're about as hopping mad as a liberal Zionist, if you even want to call them that. They're sort of like just, I call them, they're more just like Ashkenazi elites from the city, secular right. Zionists is what you would call them in Israel. They don't have a messianic attitude. And they're a problem. They're a problem for the government, but they're not, they're not a threat that Netanyahu has to face down the way he did before October 7th with the protests for judicial reform, where they actually had like military reservists refusing duty. So they're not able to turn the screws on the government.
Right. Yeah. But what about Amy Schumer? Why isn't she up in arms? Does she know this? Is she too dumb to know what Netanyahu's doing? Do you think? Amy, come on the show. Let us know.
Yeah. I don't know. She has to get approval from Chuck Schumer. But yeah, I just wanted to say, like, to your point, not caring about the captives or wanting them dead is logical for the leadership of Israel, but it's Zionist logic. It's not our logic. The Hannibal Directive is logical within the political parameters of Zionism, because the most important thing is to preserve the exclusivist Jewish state, not to preserve Jewish life. I mean, Jewish life is actually very expendable. And the Jewish state makes it so, particularly outside of the militarized frontiers of what is known as Israel. So those Jews give Hamas negotiating leverage. The goal is to totally destroy all resistance to the self-proclaimed Jewish state, no matter what they are. Like, even if they have surrendered in Syria, you have to destroy any iterations of resistance or any potential resistance. And that destruction breathes life into Zionism. It gives it dynamism because people are fighting for something, and the military is a major force for indoctrination and propagandizing the public. And then outside, which of course puts the population in further peril because they're perpetually at war. They can never snuff out all the threats. But then further afield in the so-called diaspora, we don't actually live in the diaspora. Like, this is where I am from. I'm not from Israel, but as it's known, what the Zionist movement would like more than anything, like the real hardcore believers in it, the ones who believe in what Israel's government is doing right now, is for some Gentile Nazi to walk up in a synagogue on Friday night and shoot a bunch of old ladies. They would love that. I mean, they would maybe not be like, yes, but they would be filled with indignation, and it would provide them with the political leverage they need to kind of push back against the public outrage about everything they're doing in Gaza. And so that's why we see, like, the Israeli Foreign Ministry account is a perfect example or perfect illustration of what I'm saying right now. They're complaining and howling right now because some people threw fake blood on the embassy in Amsterdam. Justifiably, I totally support doing that. You know, cheers to those who did it. It's a protest. I oppose the real blood. But just a day ago, that same account was justifying the murder of journalist Anas al-Sharif and his entire crew and the real bloodshed. So this is the dynamic where they're like, on the one hand, they're like, fuck around and find out. Yeah, you're dead, bitch. You're Hamas. And then the next day, they're, oh, this is our reality. This is our reality. We are anti-Semitism. It is Anne Frank all over again.
So disgusting.
It is. And we must censor the show Slam Frank. But, you know, and so they'd be on the good foot if they could get some real anti-Semitism going right now.
And just to clarify, when I say it's their shtick to be a safe haven for Jews and save Jewish lives, I mean, I don't think that, but people are, and Israel doesn't operate that way, but a lot of people do think that's what Israel's about. I mean, it's kind of.
No, it's just the Israel exists to give the Jewish communal life a political and spiritual boner that it wouldn't have otherwise in the United States and in Europe and elsewhere. It doesn't really serve any other purpose to Jews.
Right.
It serves purpose to imperialism, yeah, exactly. For sure.
But
like, you know, all the Jews who believe in Israel at this point, who control all of our communal institutions, they could not do with an Israel at peace, with an Israel that was not embattled. They would have nothing to do. And then they just be like, what what would like Barry Weiss or Eli Lake do? Like, what would they write about or think about? Like, there would be, their lives would be impoverished. They would, their identity would be just, they'd just be this white person in America. All those people you go up against on Piers Morgan, they'd just be white right. people.
Yeah. No grievances. They won't be persecuted minorities.
And not like interesting white people. Cause they're not, cause Zionists like that, they're not really like funny Jews or smart Jews. They're just loud and obnoxious and brazen.
Yeah. Someone posted in a tweet below a tweet. I think when I went on Piers Morgan, I tweeted out a clip and someone was like, Zionists offended by everything, ashamed of nothing, which I think is a really good, yeah.
That's good. Yeah.
Well, should we watch some of this?
Yeah. Okay.
So,
you know, I made sure not to watch it just so you're getting fresh, organic reaction.
Okay, great. Yeah. So, all right, we're going to do a little, there's a lot that we can watch, but first we're going to do a little debunking of Shabbos. And I think you'll really enjoy it. So if people don't know, I went on Piers Morgan, was it last week? Yeah, last Monday. So over a week ago. And I was told that I would be debating someone named Shabbos Kastenbaum, who is a whistleblower when it comes to anti-Semitism at Harvard. He's also affiliated with PragerU and also spoke at Kufi and talks about how, which is Christians United for Israel, and talks about how much Kufi has his back. And Kufi, of course, is that's John Hagee's mega church organization, lobby. And he does have our back in the sense that he wants us to go back in quotes to Israel, where 400 of us get to survive, I think, and everyone else gets to burn in eternal damnation. And the 400 of us who get to survive, that's because we accept Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior. So that's the guy who has our back. He also described Hitler as a hunter sent by God. And what was the other one that Hitler and Jesus, what is it? Hitler, the Antichrist is half Jewish and gay like Hitler.
Yeah, it was back in the day. It was like 2007 when John Hagee's Cornerstone Church would put these clips on YouTube and I would just watch them and just like, it was just endless entertainment. It was like hallucinating. And at one point he said that the Antichrist, when he returns, he will be half Jewish and homosexual with fierce features. He said, and he will be half Jewish as Hitler was. And I wrote something. Remember the Huffington Post? Yeah. When like you could just write whatever you wanted and it would go out to zillions of people. Like I wrote a piece about it and they took the video down. Like I,
oh man.
Should have
oh
saved
yeah.
it.
I hope someone screen grabbed it. Yeah.
That would be the greatest video to share with him, just of what he really believes. Cause, but he recently predicted that, the U.S. know that Israel will destroy Russia, Germany, and Libya and Iran in a war that was predicted in the Bible because of the reference to a place called Rush in the Book of Revelations.
Oh wow! So he decoded that. That's what that's about.
It's kind of like he has a slot in the side of his head, and like a bunch of neocons from like American Enterprise Institute, like put their policy papers in his head. And then it comes out the other side Christian. As like eschatological, apocalyptic, Pentecostal faith healing bunkum for the Fox News boomer set.
He rapture washes it. He rapture launders it. Yeah.
That's a good way of putting it.
Well, let's take a look at this clip. Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow, where for just $1 a month, you help make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary, and early access interviews. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, and Brad Bloom. Brad Bloom and Andrew Calloway are the audio engineers, and our researcher is Nate Newborn. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.